If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavers is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Solomon was the wisest man in history, outside of the Lord Jesus, of course. But the wisest man in history didn't become wise by accident. When King David died, his son Solomon assumed the throne, and God appeared to that young man in a dream and said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" In 1 Kings 3 and 2 Chronicles 1 record the request of Solomon and God's response. Solomon said, essentially, "You showed great mercy to David, my father, and now you've made me king in his place. But I'm like a child with no leadership skills. I've got no shot at doing this job unless you give me wisdom." And 1 Kings 3:10 says the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked for this thing. Because Solomon didn't ask for riches or long life or victory over his enemies, and instead simply asked for wisdom, God answered his request with a superabundance of knowledge and understanding and insight, making Solomon the wisest man to walk the earth. 1 Kings 3:12 says, God says, "Behold, I have done according to your words. Lo, I have given you a wise and an understanding heart so that there is none like you before you, neither after you shall there arise any like you." Serves as an excellent example of our text this afternoon. Now think about the situation in Solomon's life at that time. It was quite a trial. His beloved father, David, had just died. On top of that, he is now thrust into this position where he has a burden of responsibility that clearly he felt was too great to bear. Certainly that fits the description of diverse temptations up there, or various trials in verse 2. Solomon followed James's advice in advance, right? He responded by simply asking for wisdom. And just like James promises, God delivered on that humble request. If you lack wisdom, ask from God, and he will deliver it. In our verses here in verse 5 through 8 of James chapter 1, we're going to examine three keys to seeking godly wisdom. You need to know your need, know your God, and know yourself. And what we'll learn together, I hope, is that God is generous and gentle in giving wisdom to all those who ask with the intention of putting it into practice. First off, know your need. He says in verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom. Now James ends verse 4, if you remember last week, he ends verse 4 by arguing that patience or endurance has this perfecting work which makes us complete and mature. He says at the end of verse 4, wanting nothing. And then he begins verse 5 by saying, if any of you lack wisdom. He's actually used the same word twice here. In Greek, the word lipo is translated as wanting at the end of verse 4, but as lack at the beginning of verse 5. If you're using any of a more modern English translations, they've done a pretty good job of making sure they use the same word to translate the same Greek word. Most of them will say, you'll be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. And I think it's important to understand that that's the context here. So you make this connection between verse 4 and verse 5. The section that we're about to discuss about seeking godly wisdom isn't just wisdom in a general sense. James isn't bringing this up out of nowhere. It is specifically connected to enduring life's trials back in verses 2 through 4. James is writing this to those who are in the middle of difficult trials. He's called them, if you remember last week, to have this radical perspective about God's purpose in those trials. And then admitting having that radical perspective takes godly wisdom that we often lack. This is a conditional sentence, which means he's not really saying at the beginning of verse 5, some of you have wisdom and some of you don't have wisdom. What he's really saying is all of us need wisdom. So initially, you need to know that you need wisdom. But you also need to understand what wisdom really is. I'm going to ask for you to stick with me for a moment or two here, because I want to make sure that we're thinking about this term wisdom in the right way. It'll help to remember that James is writing to Jewish believers who were steeped in the Old Testament. And he's makes so many references to the Old Testament in his book that really that's the way his mindset is. Wisdom, as it is traditionally viewed in Jewish scripture of the Old Testament, is almost certainly what James intends here. And to some extent, we probably understand that wisdom is more than just knowledge, right? Wisdom is putting that knowledge into action. Primarily, the Old Testament concept of wisdom is one of technical skill put into action. Let me give you a few examples. In Exodus 31, there is a man named Bezalel who God says, I've given him wisdom to make the intricate gold and silver fixtures and artworks and the things that are necessary for the tabernacle. He was given wisdom. That wisdom was skill to put into action. In Isaiah 10:13, wisdom is extended to being able to make and execute a good battle plan. And in 1 Chronicles 28:21, the word wisdom is actually translated as skillful in describing the quality of workmanship for those who were serving in the temple. And you know from Solomon's story, when Solomon asked for wisdom, what he said was, I am like a child who doesn't have leadership skills. I need some skills. I need wisdom that can be put into action in order to perform a certain way. Maybe since James is so often compared to Proverbs in the Old Testament, it'd be good to think about that book in particular for a moment. Wisdom is viewed in Proverbs as more than knowledge on how to live, but also a willingness to put that knowledge into action, into practice. So, for example, the opposite of the wise man in Proverbs is the fool. But as Gleason Archer has noted, the fool isn't a man who is mentally deficient and lacking knowledge. There's a completely different term for that kind of guy. He's called the simple or the simpleton. The fool is not a man who is lacking mentally, but the man who is lacking morally, right? The foolish man knows what he should do, but he refuses to actually do it. The wise man both knows what he should do and puts that knowledge into skillful practice. This meaning of wisdom carries over into the New Testament. In Luke 21:15, Jesus promises disciples, I will give you a mouth and wisdom to which all your enemies will not be able to resist. Now, what's wisdom there in the terms Jesus is using? It's not simply knowledge, but the skillful application of that knowledge. James circles back around to wisdom from God later in this letter. Look over at James chapter 3 for just a moment. James chapter 3, verses 14 through 17. Listen to how God gives active and skillful wisdom. So there's a contrast here. He starts with worldly wisdom. James 3, 14. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your heart, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descends not from above. It is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Right? You hear how active godly wisdom is. It's peace-seeking, it's gentle, it's easily approachable, it's merciful, it acts without hypocrisy and without partiality. There is abundant good fruit, he says, good works. This wisdom from God isn't merely knowledge and discernment. It is skillful application of living out that knowledge and discernment. Now, the reason we're going to spend this time then to identify this true nature of wisdom is that I really think you'll misunderstand James's point here if we don't. Last week, James was telling us to consider it pure joy when you're met with all kinds of terrible trials, because you know God is working in those trials to make you mature and complete and to give you what you need to live for Him. And viewing trials that way is a hard command, and we're often left with doing what? Well, how do we do that? Not simply, you know, how do I have joy in trials, but also, well, what does confident joy in trials look like when it's put into practice? Lord, what do you want me to do here? That's what we need. We need wisdom that is skillful action, skillful execution of God's revealed truth. We need wisdom to see trials for what they are, and to skillfully apply that knowledge in our behavior. The wisdom we need is wisdom to know and the wisdom to act on what we know. So understanding what James means by wisdom helps us to grasp the verses that were just before this, right? But it's also going to be important for the verses that are coming up, because James is about to explain that if we lack wisdom, we are to, in verse 6, ask in faith. And if there's anything you need to know about faith in this letter that James has written, is that faith is what? It's active, right? It does things. So the first step in seeking godly wisdom is to know your need. You need wisdom. Secondly, you need to know your God. Verse 5, still, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given to him. James says you can ask for wisdom based on the character of God, but you need to know what God's character is. Three quick things here to note about the nature of God in this verse. First off, God gives wisdom. James doesn't say if you lack wisdom, you need to enroll in a philosophy class or climb to a mountaintop and speak to some ancient mystic guru. He says, look, just ask, but make sure you're coming to the right source. Let him ask of God. The Bible's clear about what the source of true wisdom is. Proverbs 2:6 is, for the Lord gives wisdom. Out of his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. God alone is the source of true wisdom. Now, there's a lot of false wisdom in the world, but God rejects the wisdom of this world and gives true divine wisdom. Paul contrasts this in 1 Corinthians 1, verses 20 through 24. He starts asking, well, where's the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the disputer of this world? Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. Unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness, but unto them that are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. You might not find that wisdom from God will satisfy the intellectuals of this world, for there are very few in this world who would ever look at you and say, consider it pure joy when you fall into various kinds of trials. But God's wisdom is a gift. It's something that God gives wisdom. And James is about to say down in verse 17 that every good and perfect gift is from him. God gives wisdom. And most importantly, God gave wisdom when he gave his son, Jesus, who really did consider it pure joy when he fell into each of his trials. And he endured them wisely and emerged victoriously. God's gift of his son is the ultimate key for all wisdom. Colossians 2:3 says, in him, that is in Jesus, are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So God gives wisdom. Not only that, but secondly, God is generous with wisdom. James says, ask of God, and really the way we would translate that today is probably keep on asking, because God gives to all men liberally. The word in word order in Greek and English are just different. It can become a complicated issue. If you translate phrases literally, sometimes you come out sounding like Yoda from Star Wars. But literally, this phrase from James is, ask the giving God. Giving is the very nature of God. And James goes on to say he's not only a giving God, but he gives liberally, that is generously. James is saying to pray, ask God for wisdom, because God is generous in answering those prayers. This generosity was stressed by Jesus himself, who said, ask and you'll receive, seek and you'll find, knock and it will be open to you. God's not a miser who neglects to give openly. For God can give you wisdom from a never-ending supply of wisdom. You realize when God made Solomon wise, God did not become any less wise in the process. He's willing to do this for those who ask for it. Third, God is gentle in giving wisdom. Have you ever been in a situation where you had to go to some individual and ask for something, but you just hated the idea of it because you knew how they were going to respond? Let's say you were in a spot where you had to ask a wealthy relative for money. And you already knew that even though they would give it to you, that they wouldn't want to give it to you, and they really wouldn't give you much, and certainly there's going to be a healthy dose of, well, if you weren't so irresponsible, you wouldn't have to ask in the first place. Just listen to this. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that gives to all men liberally, generously, and upbraids not, and it shall be given to him. Just ask God, because he is the giver of wisdom. He is generous with wisdom. And get this, he is ungrudging. The idea of that term, upbraids not, is that God does not go about designating your faults or criticizing you for asking. God does not scold his children when they ask for wisdom. He doesn't rebuke them for being deficient. Say, well, you should have that already. He just generously and gently gives wisdom. And so can you bring yourself to ask when you are facing one of these various trials from verse 2 and you're having a difficult time considering it to be pure joy, or you're having a hard time understanding, well, what exactly am I supposed to do here? Can you just ask, Lord, I need wisdom. Please help me to understand and show me what to do. Listen, to cry out to God for wisdom in the middle of a trial is not wrong. It is actually doing exactly what God's called us to do. So seeking godly wisdom requires that you know your need, that you know your God, and finally, that you know yourself. And I can't tell you how much I hesitate to word a point that way. You understand, when you say know yourself, there's some people today who are convinced the secret of life is within, and that leads to a certain amount of counterproductive navel-gazing. James isn't saying that wisdom comes from within. Clearly it comes from God, but he is going to call us to make a blunt assessment about our motives and our intentions. Look at verse 6 through 8. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavers is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Now, y'all, these verses may mean something different than you think. The typical explanation of verses 6 through 8 is to say that, well, when you pray and you ask God for something, you've got to believe he's going to do it. And if you don't believe, then he's not going to answer. Well, listen, you should have faith that God answers prayer because of his faithfulness, not because of your faith. That's the exact same kind of argument that faith healers use when they say, look, God's going to heal you, but you got to believe that God's going to heal you. And then if anybody doesn't get healed, whose fault is it? Well, it's your fault. Listen, when you read verse 5, doesn't it describe to you a God who is ready, willing, and able to give wisdom? He is by nature a giver. He is generous. He is gentle in the process. Verse 5 tells us that God has not made any barriers which prevents him from revealing his wisdom and his will. But verses 6 through 8 says, there might be some barriers that we're putting up. And that barrier is not about faith in the sense of, well, you've got to believe enough. Remember, in James, faith is revealed through action. And so in verse 5, we're to ask for wisdom, remembering what that wisdom is. It's not merely knowledge, but the skillful ability to put that knowledge into action. And faith is about the Christian life in action. So James here is not concerned about God's ability to give wisdom. He's concerned about your intentions in regard to the wisdom that God gives. To explain what I mean, let's focus on that word wavering for just a moment. In verse 6, that's the same word that's used in Acts 11, verse 2, for those who came to argue with Peter. It's translated as contended there, and it means, well, they were debating between two points of view. Paul uses it in Romans 14, 23, and it gets translated doubts, but it's talking about somebody who's analyzing dietary laws and deciding this is what I'm going to do, even though they're undecided really between two options. This is the sense that James is using this word in verse 6 because he says a wavering person is like someone who's tossed on the sea without any direction. When you've got two viewpoints you're debating or you've got two options you're considering, you are like a guy who's in a boat with no sail. You're wobbling one direction and then you'll suddenly be lurching the other direction. So let me try to bring this together for a second. Maybe you'll see what James intends. In verses 2 through 4 last week, you should be joyful in trials because God is always working for your benefit to cause you to mature in your Christian walk. In verse 5, you should ask God for wisdom, which is what? It's knowledge and skill in action. And God freely gives that wisdom to all who ask, as long as, in verse 6, you ask in faith. Much like wisdom, faith is active in James. It's about how you behave. And so you have to ask for wisdom with faith. You have to ask for wisdom with the intention of putting that skillful wisdom into practice. Because if you're asking God for wisdom without the intention of putting it into action, all you're doing is debating viewpoints. You're leaving some options open. You're undecided on your course of action that you're going to take. So what James is saying about praying for wisdom isn't that you have to believe enough. It's that you have to be committed to put that answer into practice. You should ask God for wisdom with the absolute intention to put that skillful wisdom into faithful action. Otherwise, what are you doing? You're not asking God for direction. You're asking God for advice. Right? Lord, why don't you tell me from your word what it is you think I should do? And then I'll kick that around for a while and I'll get some other input and I'll consider my options and I'll debate some viewpoints. And who knows? Maybe I'll decide your advice is best and give it a try. Does that sound offensive? Yeah, God's not interested in being part of your brain's internal debate club. And so James says in verse 7, let not that man think that he shall receive anything from the Lord. If you're asking because you just want another option that you might consider, but you're not committed into putting into practice, don't ask. God's gentle and generous in giving wisdom to those who have the conviction to use it. But if you're just seeking options to choose between, that's not the deal that God's offering here. So often I've seen people approach Scripture that way. They'll ask for guidance. They'll say, well, what does the Bible say about, you know, this fill-in-the-blank issue? But they don't want to know because they're going to put the answer into practice. They want to know because, well, they're kicking the tires. They aren't seeking God's wisdom because it's final authority. They're just seeking another possibility and they're keeping their options open. James describes that in verse 8 as you are double-minded. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Which is a really unique word. It seems double-minded is a word of James's own creation. In Greek, it just takes a couple of words and smashes them together. And literally, it's not double-minded, it's two-souled. If your heart is divided between commitment to God on one hand and yet a fascination with the world and all those other possibilities on the other hand, you are two-souled, you're double-minded. We'd be tempted to use the modern term two-faced. Now, James isn't adding that last verse there in verse 8 because he wants to get in like some final kick at those who aren't fully committed to God's wisdom. Remember, these people are going through trials, and this man is a pastor, and he has a pastor's heart. He cares about these people. He's giving them a stern warning where this kind of attitude is going to take them. You might be tempted to think about some trial or some situation you're in. Oh, well, I'm having a problem seeking and following God's wisdom in this particular area of life, but otherwise I'm fine. James says, no, you're not. This kind of debating, uncommitted heart is going to manifest itself throughout your life, he says. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. If you are two-souled, if you're double-minded about God's wisdom in trials, that attitude is going to start to manifest itself throughout your life. And so you can receive wisdom for your life when you have confident trust in God in an unwavering, single-minded commitment to use it. That is the message of James 1, 5 through 8. God is generous and gentle in giving wisdom to all those who ask with the intention of putting it into practice.